Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. I'm Dr. Kate Staveley, a GP from Somerset, and today I'm joined by a friend and colleague,
Dr. Peter Bagshaw, GP from Somerset and Mental Health Lead.
And today we're talking about a subject that's very interesting and is in the media quite a lot, and that is the subject of ADHD. And we're joined by two of our colleagues who are experts in this area. Kate and Rosie, please, could you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourselves?
So I'm Dr. Kate Franklin. I'm a consultant psychiatrist that works in the Somerset Adult ADHD team.
And hi, everybody. My name is Rosie Grenter, and I'm the clinical lead for the Adult ADHD service for Somerset Foundation Trust. Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Lovely to have you.
So, why ADHD? What brought you into studying the area of ADHD in the first place? And what is so interesting about ADHD?
So for me, I've been really interested in neurodiversity in general since I did a science degree at university before doing medical school. So my final year project was in teaching emotion recognition to children with autism with a cartoon animation, a bit like Thomas the Tank Engine. So my interest grew from there, and I thought that I'd go into medicine wanting to be a psychiatrist, possibly working with children, and then realised actually the world of neurodiversity continues into adulthood, and this is how I've ended up in the world of ADHD.
And Rosie?
And I've got a slightly similar story. So I'm a mental health nurse by background. And so I've been a mental health nurse for 24 years. And I started working in children, young people's mental health services and predominantly with looked after children in the very early days of my career, where I saw lots of children, young people who came from very different backgrounds, who had had different parenting experiences and a lot of trauma. And what I began to realise was that a lot of looked after children were being diagnosed with ADHD or autism. And when I started to look into that in a little bit more detail, I realised there were these significant overlaps between all of those conditions. And so began to get really curious in unpicking, was this trauma, was this ADHD? Are we misdiagnosing a lot of children and young people? So my interest in that area grew and evolved over time. And in my windy journey in my career, I started to develop nurse-led neurodevelopmental services for children and young people in community paediatrics. And then went to do that in child and adolescent mental health services. I did my prescribing qualification. And then I've evolved into adult services. So similarly to Kate, really, you know, realising that these conditions move into adulthood. And I'm particularly interested in those young people transitioning into adult services and how we can make those pathways a lot smoother for them. So lots of common themes there and areas of interest and excitement in what is a very exciting area of medicine to work in.
And you both really raised some absolutely fascinating points there. So you talked about neurodiversity, about links between different conditions, and that's something we've only begun to realise fairly recently, isn't it? Do you both want to unpack that a little bit? Because it's a fascinating area.
So absolutely, you're absolutely right. Diagnostically, we've only been able to diagnose both, for example, ADHD and autism relatively recently, which is hugely surprising because I think as clinicians, we've realised that these conditions co-occur for a really long time. And it's the overlap between the neurodiverse conditions, which is also really interesting, and how it changes how each person presents and the symptoms they have. We're so different from person to person, and that's what I find particularly interesting with our client group and the patients that we see, is trying to unpick which of the neurodiverse conditions, if any, do these people have, and how does it affect and impact their life.
And I think we have, just following on, I think what we have an opportunity to do is really help that person understand what's going on for them and why do they experience the world in the way that they do, because with understanding brings confidence and more opportunity to support that person in going in achieving whatever it is they want to do in their life. So it's very rewarding as well. And I think we've got a real privilege with working with this client group.
And your service caters for adults, so that's 18 plus. Are these adults who were diagnosed with ADHD as children, or are these adults who hadn't realised they had ADHD until later in life?
Yeah, so absolutely. Our service looks at that latter group. So anyone who wasn't diagnosed as a child, everyone that comes to our service has their symptoms in childhood to a variable degrees. But absolutely, we see those people who weren't picked up during childhood, who then come to us as an adult experiencing symptoms of ADHD.
And before we dive in too deeply into all these links and this fascinating topic, perhaps we better start off with some definitions, have we? So do you want to tell us, what does ADHD stand for? How does it present? What does it mean? And a little bit about defining neurodiversity and autism as well, if possible.
So ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And from that, we mean that we're expecting to see in a person problems with their attention, such as lack of concentration, inability to focus on a task, frequently switching between tasks. Lots of people tell us that they start lots of projects and then never finish them, so often spending lots of money on various hobbies along the way. We see impulsive symptoms, which are, for example, people blurting out answers to questions, interrupting other people during conversations, and hyperactive symptoms, which are typically fidgeting, inability to relax. And we don't need to see evidence of each of those three areas in a person. You can just have, for example, inattention, so the inability to concentrate type symptoms. We also look at whether and how these symptoms impact on a person's life. So that could be in education and employment, relationships, friendships, parenthood, life admin, those kind of repetitive tasks, filling in questionnaires that can be really difficult for some people. And as I say, we need to see that there's a childhood narrative that these symptoms were present since the person was a child.
You can't develop ADHD. You can't, as an adult, you wouldn't suddenly develop ADHD having never had any problems as a child.
So you wouldn't suddenly develop ADHD, but as a person goes through life, often a lot of scaffolds fall away. So it's very structured and routine in school. You often have the input from a parent or caregiver who can scaffold life and support you. And often when people transition into adulthood, those fall away. And it can be then, and also particularly during menopause for a woman, that we see these symptoms coming about in adulthood. And it's also important to say that there's many other disorders that can cause these symptoms and impact life in this way. And so we need to thoroughly explore all of the other possible mental health and physical health conditions that could be explaining these symptoms. And it's only then that we would come to the conclusion that a person has a diagnosis of ADHD.
And do these symptoms present in the same way in men and women?
So it can be really different from person to person. And what we know is that ADHD is diagnosed much more commonly in boys and men than it is in women. And that is often because they demonstrate the more hyperactive and impulsive symptoms. So they typically get picked up as a child in a classroom for being disruptive, whereas a typical presentation for a woman, and by all means, this is not for everybody, but typically they demonstrate the more inattentive symptoms. So will be there daydreaming in the back of the classroom, looking out of the window, not really paying attention, but don't come to the attention of, for example, teachers and parents to such a degree because of the difference in the symptom profile.
And of course, that applies to autism as well, doesn't it? Where it's diagnosed far more commonly in males. And I don't know whether that represents a real difference in prevalence or whether it's just that the symptoms are more obvious and easier to pick up. What are your views on that?
I think there's a combination of both. So in my experience of working, particularly with children, young people, as much as we're talking about adults in our service, my clinical background is you know, children and people. So if I think about the girls that I've worked with over the years who have done a really great job of hiding and masking and not being seen and have developed a range of quite sophisticated coping strategies that have meant that when parents or carers have said, actually, I think there might be something going on, it's been really difficult for any professional around them to really communicate that or observe that, because that young person has done a really good job of hiding it. And it's really interesting because I think we see this a lot in our adult group as well. So as Kate was just describing, when we meet somebody for an assessment, we do a really good deep dive and we really spend a lot of time getting to know that person and getting to know what's going on for them and what's brought them to the service. And particularly in women, we hear this story unfold time and time again. I just got on with it. I just coped. I had all these other things happening. I was working. I was, you know, raising children. I was doing these various things. And it was only when I read that, I saw that, I met that person, I realised there was something else going on. And so I think that's where we see those differences. I think the other thing in amongst that is, as a society, thankfully, we have got far better at asking for what we need. I think we've got better about talking about mental health and emotional well-being. And I think we are getting less fearful of speaking out when something isn't quite right. I think we are journeying into a society where there is less shame about talking about things not being okay. So I think it's multifaceted. I think there's many reasons why we're seeing an increase in referrals and we are seeing more awareness out there in society generally.
And it is recognised within academic circles and the research that the imbalance in that ratio between the diagnosis between boys and girls or men and women, it is becoming more balanced over time. And there is also an inherent bias in the research that has been done in the past, looking at only males and boys, which then also influences, for example, how we diagnose or the screening tools that we might use, which can also impact on how we view ADHD, autism, and other neurodiversity in men and women differently.
So we're evolving. We're evolving. You know, research is really informing our evidence base and our practice. We're learning, we're really rapidly learning all the time. And so I'm really grateful to be in this very exciting field of work where everything is moving forward in a really positive way.
And of course, ADHD is different from other neurodiverse conditions in that there is some medication that can help people with it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
And what's so exciting about medication for ADHD is that it's some of the most effective medication for any physical health or mental health condition. But if we can get the person on the correct medication and the right dose, lots of people find it really helpful for all of their symptoms and the impact that then that has in easing things in all different spheres of their life. Saying that, though, medication alone is rarely ever the entire answer for somebody. And it's about looking at what particular strategies can you use as a person to make your forgetfulness, for example, of remembering appointments, what can you do to scaffold that and bring alongside the non-medication strategies alongside our medication. And medication for ADHD falls into two main categories, which is our stimulant medication, things such as methylphenidate, and lots of people I think would have heard of things like Ritalin or Concerta. There's other types of stimulants as well. And then also what we call non-stimulant medication for ADHD.
And some people choose, you know, if they get a diagnosis, some people actually choose that medication isn't the way forward for them, because for that person, actually having that diagnosis and having that knowledge to bring the understanding, a different understanding about themselves, is actually enough. So what we do is really support people in making an informed decision that feels right for them.
I'm really glad you say that, because although the medication is incredibly effective, it does have side effects. It is quite a powerful drug, isn't it? So could you say a little bit more about the non-medication ways of dealing with ADHD? What strategies people might want to adopt if they think they've got it and are on a waiting list to be seen or medication?
So there's a whole range of I'm in favour of an app. My my patient group are fantastic at keeping us very informed about apps. So there's some really good apps out there that help you plan, help you organise, helps you set reminders, set alarms for things, checklists, all sorts of different things. So I think it's having lots of different things in place that help you organise your mind. So it's the executive function. So it's the bit that helps you with organising, planning, thinking about the next bit, breaking tasks down into different stages. That's the bit that kind of gets a bit jammed up. So any strategy that you can put in place that helps you break down tasks, help you make things feel a little bit less overwhelming, tick those tick lists off the list. Anything like that is really, really helpful. And different things work for different people. Some people like to write a list down and tick it off as they go along. Some people like an app or an electronic note or whatever works for them. I like an app personally because I like to tick things off, but different things work for different people. And what we can do is compile a bit of a list to go on the website, and then people can dive in and find out what works for them.
That would be excellent. Do you think people need to have a formal diagnosis of ADHD? Or do you think, you often hear about people self-identifying that they have ADHD. Is that valid? Can they get help from all these different resources? I know they can't get medication, but...
I think if it's valid for that person, then it's valid. And it's about what people want to do, I think. So if somebody feels really if their symptoms are very impactful, then having a diagnosis with the potential prescribed medication, if that's going to transform their life and help them function and do the things that they want to do with their life, then absolutely that's the way forward. But if somebody really feels, actually, no, I have this, but having a diagnosis probably isn't going to change or transform my life in any meaningful way, then reading around subjects, getting a better sense of what ADHD is and how that might fit with them could be enough for them. So it's a really hard one to answer because everybody's got very individual views. And as I said, you know, part of our job as clinicians is to support people with making a decision that's a good fit for them.
And as we were talking about earlier, there's lots of other conditions that can cause the same or similar problems that you experience with ADHD. And what we're really interested in starting to do is trying to support people whilst they're on our waiting list, which is an extensive waiting list as it is nationally for ADHD. And I think you're right that there is a real commonality there, that just regardless of whether or not a person will come out with a diagnosis at the end of it, people can use the same strategies for these common difficulties, regardless of whether or not they're due to ADHD or another disorder.
That's really helpful. Can I pick up on something else you said earlier? Rosie, you mentioned that very often you see a link with childhood trauma. Now, we know this plays a major part in mental health issues later in life. And we now talk about ACEs, don't we? Adverse childhood events. And we know, for instance, it's one of the main drivers for things like borderline personality disorder. Can you say a little bit more about the impact of childhood trauma and how often you think that plays a part in developing ADHD?
So I guess I think about the impact of trauma on the young and developing brain. So there's a lot of evidence base that suggests that for children, young people who are constantly in a state of fear, in a constant state of high anxiety, hypervigilance, having to be on full alert, so they're running on those chemicals, those hormones, that adrenaline, that cortisol, that can impact on the development of the brain. And there's a lot of research out there, and there's a lot of really great and quite worrying and upsetting, actually, MRI scans of the brain, which shows you sort of the difference between a child who's been in a really secure place and how their brain's developed versus a child who hasn't. So for me, it stands to reason that if you have a child who is constantly in that state of fear, needs to be on hyper alert, needs to be, there's no space to relax, everything is dangerous, the world is dangerous, that is going to replicate some of the more high energy, the hyperkinetic symptoms of ADHD that we see. So if we compare the two. So therefore, this is why we see this overlap. And so for some children, young people, that trauma, that need to be on high alert all the time can evolve into more ADHD symptoms because they're neurologically hardwired to be on high alert. And equally, if we make a diagnosis, medication alongside really robust attachment focused parenting can actually really support that child or young person with emotional regulation, education, peer developing friendships, and all those things that children with ADHD more organically will have as well. And it's a really long journey. That trauma recovery is long, and it takes a lot of hard work from a multi-agency, really well qualified team around that child to support them with moving forward.
What I find so interesting about working with people with ADHD or who believe they might have a diagnosis of ADHD is that ADHD very rarely comes along just as ADHD on its own. There's so many other conditions, both physical conditions and mental health conditions, that come alongside it, including things like trauma, but also thinking about depression or anxiety, other neurodevelopmental disorders. There's a whole host of physical health conditions that are much more common in those people who are neurodiverse. And picking out, is this ADHD plus something else? Is it just something else? Yeah. Is it just ADHD? Is it trauma? It's just so fascinating. Mm. And in our experience, people find it so rewarding to have that wide view of all of their problems considered in a really long ADHD assessment where we are looking at all aspects of their life and hopefully coming out with a formulation at the end of it, so an understanding of that person at the end of it that explains all of their difficulties for them.
And that family link as well. So again, I've often, which is sort of new and emerging information, so that genetic link that goes through maybe generations of family members where everybody's got these symptoms, but we didn't talk about it, we didn't know about it, sort of particularly with our more senior members of our families, you know. And certainly I've assessed children, young people, where the parent or parents have then come to me afterwards and said, okay, as we were going through that assessment, I really recognised those traits in myself. How do I get myself assessed?
And I think as GPs, we see that a lot. So we often see these neurodiversity traits running through families. And having been a GP for a long time, I can look back and think, oh yeah, I remember your grandmother used to be like that. That makes sense. Yes. I can see that going down the family. And it's fascinating seeing those connections. We were nearly running out of time, and I just really wanted to touch base on how can we help people with ADHD? So if you have a work colleague or a friend or a family member with ADHD, how can we best support them?
So I think listening with non-judgment and acceptance, I think, is probably my top tip. I think if people are struggling at work, if they have a diagnosis, they can get support through Access to Work. ADHD is officially recognised under the Equalities Act 2010 as disability, so they have a right to reasonable adjustments. And again, we can provide some information to go on the website if anybody's in struggle.
Is there information as an employer that you can, so if you're a concerned employer, what could you go and read about so you could better understand somebody with ADHD?
There's a raft of books and literature out there, and again, we can put, and there's national websites, again, we can put some information out there. And if you want to get support for your employee, again, through Access to Work, the Access to Work website actually gives information for employer and employee. So that's a really good starting point if you want to know a little bit about reasonable adjustments.
And we'll put that on the show notes at the end. David has put the link in for us. We've talked about it as a disability, and it can be really difficult to live with. But I've also seen things where people describe it as a superpower. Do you think that's going too far, or do you think that has some validity?
I think it's really impositive. It's about embracing embracing everybody's qualities. So I think there are qualities to having a neurodiverse brain. And I think we should focus on the diverse element of neurodiversity. We need diverse people to make up the eclectic society that we have. You know, we need our innovative people, we need our creative people. And I think there's a flip side to everything, isn't there? You know, certainly some of my patients have said to me, well, I'm a real risk taker and sometimes I'm really frightened myself. However, it got me here and I applied for that job and look where I landed because and their impulsivity has actually set them in good stead. So I don't think calling it a superpower is going too far at all. I think it's really important that we embrace this element of ADHD and the positivity.
I think that's a super place to finish on, the positivity of ADHD. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but do either of you have something you would just like to say at the end to finish up with? Kate?
Just thank you very much for what's been a really interesting and stimulating discussion from my point of view. I've really enjoyed speaking with you this afternoon.
Thank you.
And I wanted to share some wisdom that was shared with us. Kate and I recently attended the UK Adult ADHD National Conference. And we had a panel of experts by experience who were asked to share their top tips for living with ADHD. And they said, forgiveness routine, journaling, so writing in a diary, nutrition, exercise, and compassion.
Thank you. What a lovely place to finish on. Thank you both very much. And to all our listeners, go well.
You've been listening to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. The show was hosted by our team of doctors, including Dr. Andrew Tresidder, Dr. Peter Bagshaw, and Dr. Kate Staveley. The show was produced by David Seeley and Bob Hunt's music.